You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Increasing clouds across the mountains today. A chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the lower 90s. Tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms early. Mostly clear overnight with lows around 70. Sunshine and clouds on Saturday. Another round of showers and thunderstorms. Some of the storms could be severe. It'll be hot with highs in the mid-90s. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today I'm going solo on a topic I've had a lot of interest in over the years. That topic is acting and theater, but acting most specifically. First off, I'm coming to this topic not as an actor. I'm coming to this topic as somebody who's always had an interest in acting, and I've flirted with it quite a bit over the years, but I've never been an actor in the sense of being cast in a play, having to develop a character, repeat the character over and over until the play's run is finished. That said, I have presented many shows around memorized poetry, and I've had the chance to explore a lot of techniques that are involved in acting to build up the characters. So I do know something about it, but I don't have that professional level that a lot of actors I know have. I do have a great deal of respect for the acting profession. I think it might be one of the most difficult of all jobs to do if you do it professionally and you do it as a career over a long period of time. When I was growing up, I think I saw a few plays in school, but not that many. My exposure to acting was television and going to the movies. I used to love to go to the movies. I lived in Asheville, grew up there in the 50s and the 60s. The Imperial Theater was downtown Asheville, and so too was the Plaza Theater. On Saturday afternoons, I'd go to the movies at the Imperial or the Plaza. I don't remember how much we paid now, probably not all that much, and I would watch the movies. I don't even remember the movies, but I do remember the drama, the actors, the way these old stories transported me somewhere. And that was my introduction to acting. It was from the audience point of view, not from a practical point of view. And yet, I'll bet you that almost everybody you know can tell you experiences they've had viewing movies or television shows or any kind of screen action, including games and whatnot. They've had a lot of exposure to the outcomes of acting. The reason why somebody would spend ages and ages working the craft in order to appear real on the stage or on the screen. So in many ways, actors attempt to do what you and I do every day, which is show up and be real in our lives. Show up and ask questions about things we're curious about. Exchange conversations with somebody in a grocery store maybe you've never met before. Make change somewhere at the gas station. All of these little things that we do, if you were an actor attempting to act them, your goal would be to create such a believable moment when you're on film or on the stage that it feels exactly truthful, like those moments you have when you're interacting with people on a day-to-day basis. So acting isn't some grand proposition. It's really more, at least in my mind, a way of figuring out how to understand all of the layers of what's going on in your ordinary life, or from the actor's point of view, the layers that are going on in the character's ordinary life. And when I use the word ordinary, I use the word ordinary in the best sense of ordinary. It's what's going on as we move through our lives. Occasionally something extraordinary will happen. You win the lottery, or you have an extraordinary day when you get married, or you have an extraordinary walk. Something shines. It's a little bit beyond the morning coffee, the keys lost under the pillow, the drive to town to buy some groceries. Ordinary. And yet, when you think about life, even those ordinary times might qualify as extraordinary when you pull back and you look at the context that you're in. The fact that you're alive and here and breathing makes the entire proposition extraordinary. All the more reason not to overplay it and be overly descriptive and dazzling descriptive about it. More accept it as it is. So in acting, there's a real balance between that. And then when you are acting and watching actors perform on the stage or in the screen, they sometimes have to go to places that you don't go to during your ordinary days. I mean, drama, after all, means something has to happen. The air conditioner falls out of the window. The tire goes flat when you're rushing to get to an important meeting. Someone has an accident and they break their arm and they can no longer take the trip with you. Something has to happen. And once that something happens, the stakes go up. And when the stakes go up, the actors have to track the rise of the stakes and build those stakes into the character they're developing. And the best way to develop a character is to get out of your own way. That's one of the reasons why I decided to not be a professional actor. I have a strong enough ego and a fairly grounded sense of self, which works fine, until I have to take on an acting role. Now, like I said, I've never taken on a role in a play, maybe a couple of plays back when I was studying acting in college. I did do a few plays. I didn't really understand what I understand now. So it's not like I haven't done it. It's just that I haven't done it in a full-on throw myself into it way. And there are two reasons. First of all, I've traveled a lot, so I'm never in one place long enough to actually commit to a 3-month rehearsal stretch. Second of all, like I said, I have a fairly strong ego and a strong sense of self. So when I have attempted over the years to develop characters within the context of poems, more than within the context of a theatrical presentation, even so, the technique is the same. Memorize a longer poem, develop it from a character point of view, and if there are characters in the poem, develop those characters within the poem from the point of view of what they're speaking about or how they're approaching life. So my ego and my sense of self, because it's strong, prevents me very often from committing to fully the characters in the poems. And I suspect also that might be the case if I were to be in a play. Too much of the me of me would come out and the character would get discounted because of my meanness, my sense of self. Now, I don't know if that's true. I could probably work it so that wouldn't happen. But it's been a problem for me, and it's a problem that's the good kind of problem. You can have a good problem. And the reason it's a good problem is because I've always known it's there. So when I do work with poetry and do work developing my oral storytelling presentations around this material, I'm constantly aware that I'm getting in my way. And the creative challenge for me is to figure out how to get out of my way, to let you see me, to let me see you, you being in the audience, me being on the stage, or in the round at a house concert, or anywhere else for that matter. The main idea is to allow people to see you, allow them to look into you. Intimacy, into me see, can you see into me, and am I willing to allow that? And what I mean by seeing into me, am I capable of inviting you to watch me experiment with this process of development? I'm doing a bit of it right here on this show. I'm sitting at my desk in Arroyo Seco, New Mexico. It's a fine June day, very warm outside, and I am creating this as I go. This isn't a spontaneous improvisational piece of work. It's me organizing my thoughts and allowing you to track this organization, and then me having enough wherewithal to put the show together and then air it on WPVM-FM in Asheville, KCEI-FM in Taos, and put it on the platforms as a podcast. So in acting or in any other creative endeavor, are you willing to allow people to witness your work, witness your process? Now, that doesn't mean that you always have to stand on the public square and draw your pictures or take your photos or recite your work out loud. But it does mean at some point when you want to present your work publicly in different arenas, if you keep that sensibility of allowing people to experience the work that you do, experience it on their own terms, allow themselves to develop their own characters around the work that you present, rather than always worrying about what people will think, or is it going to be successful, or how well will it be received. All those things are important and worth paying attention to. And you will get the best results when you pay attention to the audience as much as you're paying attention to the desires that you have. Acting is definitely an individual artistic expression, full of skills, focused on one direction, which is to develop a character or characters, play those characters, and move on to developing more and more characters and exploring all the nuances of the human way of going about things, the way you think, the way you philosophy, the way you interact with other people. How close do you think acting is to everyday life? It may be closer than you think. So let's explore that idea of how you can transfer some of these acting techniques, these acting principles, acting strategies over to your everyday life and maybe into the creative life that you're living or the creative life that you would like to start living more of. Or if you don't think you're doing it at all, maybe you might start a little today. So hopefully this will be part of that advancement, that exploration, that inquiry, and what will come next for you and how you can put all this together so it can have more meaning for you in your life. When I was in my 20s, I had no sense of what it meant to be an actor. I had a little inkling that I wanted to be an actor like so many people have when they're young. Oh, I'd love to be a famous actor. So I tied fame and acting together. I suspect if you don't know anything about the craft of acting, it's easy to do that because the Academy Awards talk about fame. Magazines talk about fame. All the famous people. You probably already know this. Fame is fleeting. Fame is seriously overrated. You can be famous for a little while, and yet it only lasts a little while. Even the most famous people, an icon that maybe you know, maybe you don't, Elizabeth Taylor. There was a time when she was considered the most beautiful woman on the screen. Everybody knew her name, a household name. Now, as the years move on, I wonder how many people who are 24, 25 know who Elizabeth Taylor was. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Jack Nicholson, another example. Back in the day, his name was a household name. The other day, I was on a conversation with a fellow who lives in the Philippines. He travels to the States a lot. He's in the know. He's 30 years old. He works in advertising and marketing. And we were talking about fame. And I said to him, I said, well, Binge, fame is fleeting, man. You never know how long it will last. I said, take, for example, the actor Jack Nicholson. Do you know who Jack Nicholson is? And Benj said, I think I know who Jack Nicholson. I said, he was a movie star way back in the day. And he paused a few minutes. He says, oh, yeah. He was the guy on The Shining. Yeah, I remember him. He was on The Shining. Point is, Benj barely knew who Jack Nicholson was. He probably would have known who Elizabeth Taylor was, but he wouldn't think of her as a famous movie star. He might think of her as an actor that he knows a little bit about. The point is, in my 20s, I didn't know anything about acting. I was like everybody else. So I associated acting with fame and movie stars. I didn't associate acting with a hard-earned skill that takes a lifetime to develop, and you have to continue with it. Like any other craft, if you don't practice, you lose your chops and you're not able to do it anymore. So acting is like all the other crafts. And sometimes, if you get lucky, you can move your acting craft into something people call art. But of course, that's for somebody else to say, not for you. Your job is to just simply practice. So in acting, practice is one of the most important things somebody could do. Now, I do know something about acting. Like I said, I've never acted in a play, but I have spent time taking acting classes. My first experience with acting classes came when I was in my early 30s, and I was an adult returning student back at the University of North Carolina in Asheville. This was in the early 80s. I had decided by that point to memorize poems and tell them as stories. So I was motivated to take some acting classes because I figured, well, if I want to tell stories, I better know a little bit about how you do it. And the only place I could think of to go, acting, the theater, which was on the campus of UNCA. And there were courses I could take. So I signed up for acting 101, 102, 103, and 104. Did I learn how to act in those acting classes? Sure, I learned the basics. I learned what subtext was. I learned what superobjective was. I learned how to examine the needs of the character and use the sense of what the character needed to develop the drive that would make the character move forward within the context of the play. And indeed, the classes did help. When I started memorizing the poems, I was able to bring some of that thinking into the pieces I memorized. Probably the biggest benefit I got from those UNCA acting classes was an understanding of how to develop a relationship with the text that I was memorizing, which was an unexpected benefit. I was not thinking so much about memorization when I started taking my acting classes. I was thinking more about how I looked on stage, how I sounded on stage, how people perceived me. And here you can get a sense of my own ego and self-centeredness coming out. I was worried about how you see me. I wasn't worried about making art by way of developing a character. I wanted to be a poetry teller, a storyteller. I wanted to stand on the stage and show everybody how smart I was, show everybody how skilled I was, what a talent I was. Those are all the worst reasons to develop an acting career or a stage presence for storytelling or poetry telling. At the time, I didn't know better. It took a long time for me to come to understand this is more about an internal quest than it is about something designed for approval, recognition, or attention. But how can you learn anything all at once? It takes time to figure all of these things out. Going back to the big benefit that I picked up in those early acting classes, the benefit of memorization. And I bring that up because I thought memorization was all about learning the words. I didn't know it was about having a relationship with the text that could be internalized and built into my personality or built into the character that I was trying to develop around the poem, for example. So while I was taking my acting classes at UNCA, and I was also taking French and getting an undergraduate degree in international relations, so I had three things going all at the same time. And then the fourth thing on the side, really, was my interest in learning how to tell poems, perform poems as theater, as a way of understanding the poetry, and also as a way of developing an opportunity to be in the performance arena without having to commit to 3 months, 4 months in some sort of play somewhere. Because I was always on the road, roaming, looking around the next corner. So I made a compromise in one way. I also made a lot of really strong choices in the direction of transferring what I was learning in the acting classes over to the performance poetry chops that I was trying to develop. So if you're listening to this and you have some interest in theater and acting, and yet you have a life that won't allow you to go to rehearsals for 2 months or 3 months, you can instead work with poems. And they're short, they're easy to work with, and you get a lot of awareness around them. And even though poems are short, the development can take quite a bit of time. The stories behind the poems can be very long. Let's take Robert Frost's poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are? I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and the frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. So that was my memorized version, my performance, if you will, of Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. So how would you use acting techniques to memorize and develop this poem? So here's how you do it. If you have something you'd like to memorize and perform, the first thing you do, as I said earlier, you need to develop a relationship with it. You need to understand what the story is that's behind the poem, all the layers. Now, what makes a poem work really well, like Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, and what makes a poem memorable, because you likely are familiar with that poem, even if you're not a big fan of poetry, it's the layering that makes it stick. So when you choose to work with a piece that has a lot of layering, like Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, you have many, many opportunities over a long period of time to unpack all of the possibilities there. I have known this poem since 1984. It's one of the first ones I memorized. And I have recited it, performed it, read it, thought about it over the arc of all these decades. And even now, when I performed it or recited it for you just now, it had different layers for me than it did the last time I performed it or the last time I thought about it. So when you're developing your work, and if you are working with the work that you've written, material that you've created, you may not think of yourself as a great American poet like Robert Frost. What you will discover, though, is that you have a great number of layers built into what you write, regardless of whether you're just beginning or whether you've been doing it for a long, long time. We can trust our creative range. So, who is the character in Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening? The poem works really well because Robert Frost does not tell you who is in the poem. I have no idea who's on that carriage going through the woods with the horse. I do know some things. I do know it's the darkest evening of the year. I don't know for sure that it is in New England, but I do know it's in snow country. And it's easy to assume that's the northern hemisphere. So it gives me a sense that the nights are very long in snow country. So what time could I assume? Maybe it's 5:30. Maybe 6, could be later, could be deeper in the woods. One thing we know that the driver can see where he's going. Does that mean the moon is out? Certainly no lights, it's deep, dark woods. He has to illuminate his path some way. He must know his way through the woods. He's obviously traversing some kind of road or a wide enough path to get the sled through. He's not just rambling through the brambles trying to make his way to the other side of the woods. So we have that. So we know the time of day could be anywhere between, well, really, in the northern hemisphere, it gets dark around 4 p.m. So as the creative, the person going to perform the poem, I have to decide, what time is it? Is it midnight? Is it 3 a.m.? Is it 4 p.m.? I have a sense, at least for me, that it's around 7:30 p.m. in the evening. It's been dark for a while. He's been traveling a bit. He gives information about how dark the woods are. So there's some suggestion that he's been out there more than just a few minutes. So I'm going to choose 7:30. So what would happen if instead of 7:30, I chose 4 a.m.? That would be a very different vibe in the performance. 4 a.m. would mean he'd been traveling all night. 4 a.m. would mean he was bone tired. 4 a.m. would really put some context around, I have miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. Now that I think about it, I could easily choose 4 a.m. because he still has a long way to go, suggesting perhaps he might travel through the whole day. If I choose 7:30, it suggests that he might be traveling through the whole night. So where will he be when 4 a.m. comes? Those are questions the poem does not give us answers to, and yet I can make choices around that. How far will I go on this sleigh? Who am I? Let's talk about the horse. How long has he owned the horse? What kind of relationship does he have with the horse? Where does he live and where does he house his horse? He has to have enough means in order to own a horse. He's not just walking through the woods without a carriage. He has a sleigh and he has a horse. So that tells you he has some kind of affluence, some sort of support, maybe not a lot. He might be a working class fellow who uses his sleigh, his carriages, and his horses, or his one horse, to deliver coal, to deliver groceries. Who knows what he does with it? All you know is it's very dark. It's the darkest evening of the year, so that means it's the winter solstice. The earth is going to make its turn back towards summer, and you can assume he's bundled up. Now, is he headed home for the Christmas holidays? The darkest evening of the year comes a few days before Christmas. Maybe he's headed home, or maybe he's lost his family, and he's thinking of the fellow in the village who has a house, and he may be thinking, I no longer have a house. I'm just traversing this woods all alone. Some people say he's thinking of suicide. I don't interpret it like that, but you, in academic reading, you'll see that. He definitely is aware there's darkness around him. So the darkness becomes a metaphor. So when I'm performing this poem, the more I talk about it, the more I think about it, the more I play around with the words, the more information comes into me. So when I read the poem a few moments ago, I gave it a little bit of the background. I performed it, if you will. I lived into it a bit. So to me, performance means living into something. It doesn't mean swinging from the trapeze in the circus. There's performativity, and then there's performing. So to me, performativity is when you overdo it. When you perform something, it's more subtle. Can you storytell it? Like right now, I'm definitely performing this show. And yet I'm not reading a script. I'm following my thought beats, and I'm allowing myself to unpack these ideas around acting and how you can transfer these ideas in more personal ways into any kind of reading or performance or presentation that you do. So you have the internal stuff. He's wondering about home. He's wrapped up. He's cold. And then you have the external stuff. The darkest evening of the year tells you how confining it is. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. What kind of information do you have there? Downy flake means it's snowing. You know it may be snowing heavily because that's what happens in the Northern Hemisphere. You know that Robert Frost is a New England poet, so it's easy to make the assumption. He doesn't tell you. It's easy to assume. It's somewhere in New England. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. Ah, information. easy wind. So you know this is not a howling storm. You know there is no danger. It's an easy wind. It's not a breeze, so it has a little bit of force to it. It's still a wind. And you can hear the ease of the wind in the line of poetry. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. So it's not the torrent of easy wind. It's the sweep of easy wind. The sweep of easy wind. The sweep of easy wind. I said the sweep of easy wind, now counting this moment, four times. Likely, as you've listened to me say it, you will remember the sweep of easy wind. You might even remember the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. You have to ask this question. Why flake? Why not the sweep of easy wind and downy flakes? It would seem logical that he would say flakes because when it's snowing, you have more than one flake. Lots and lots of flakes. It's a flaky night. The snow is flaking around. So when I think of the swirls, I think of a lot of snow. And yet, Robert Frost chooses downy flake. Why? Well, first of all, it sounds a lot better. The sweep of easy wind and downy flake closes things out. If I say the sweep of easy wind and downy flakes, nah, it doesn't work quite as well. One shift makes all the difference. Another way to look at it, we all know that every snowflake is different. So by including the singular flake instead of the plural flakes, Robert Frost focuses our attention, subtly, on the single man in the sleigh. The single flake, the single man. We all know there are billions of people on Earth, but for this poem, Robert Frost doesn't need a billion people. It's focused on one man going through the woods all alone. So the poem has a loneliness theme about it. So if you're developing your material around this poem, you start to examine how you feel when you're lonely. How many times have you been in the woods, metaphorically, or maybe you've been lost in the woods or you've been traversing the woods? How many times have you been cold? How many times have you wanted to go somewhere, or you were trying to get somewhere and maybe you were thwarted along the way? So when you develop a piece like the character in Stopping by Woods, you can ask all of these questions. How many times have you been lost? Probably more than one. So choose one. Choose a time when you were lost and let that be the focus of your performance when you're presenting your aloneness in the woods. Choose a place you're going to go. Maybe you prefer to go to your own cabin somewhere far away. You're all by yourself. Decide how many members of the family you've left behind or how many members of your family you're headed towards. So all of these decisions come to play. Now, I could go on and on and on with this. Robert Frost doesn't tell us if it's a man or a woman driving. I've always assumed it was a man because Robert Frost often wrote poems that placed himself in the piece, or at least I felt like it was. So I've always thought some version of Robert Frost was driving the sleigh. That said, you can choose whomever you like to put in that sleigh. If it's not you, it can be somebody else you can play. You can choose the age, you can choose the sex, you can choose the background. You can choose whether the person's born in the area or whether the person has just arrived from another country or from a warmer part of the U.S. Doesn't really matter. What matters in this kind of work and what matters in acting is you have the sovereignty to make creative choices. And when you make strong creative choices, they will lock down in your creative memory and you don't have to remember them consciously. They will be there. And the more you work with it, the more you will develop the way you say it. If you are reading aloud to one person, that's a performance. Even if you're sitting on stage and you're reading silently, letting people watch you, that's also a performance. And when you're rehearsing alone in your room by yourself or singing in the shower, you're performing then as well. So I hope you're now getting to see what I mean by developing a relationship with a piece of writing. And as you develop that relationship and you become more and more familiar with it, a conversation begins. You learn more about yourself. You learn more about what the poem means. Maybe you also learn a bit about the poet as well. And also, if you are a writer, you will learn a whole lot about writing. For example, the title, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, gives you a fair amount of information. Evening, that means it's early. It wouldn't be 4 a.m. That said, you could still switch it to 4 a.m. if you wanted to play around with the creative nature of your own ideas. You also know the sleigh is stopped, stopping by woods. Sleigh is sitting still. You don't know how long the driver has been driving. You don't know anything else except the scene. Dark woods, sleigh sitting still in snow. That's not poetry. That's description. And yet that's the essential part of developing this. And believe me, this works with any text that you could put in front of you. If you spend a little time asking these kind of questions of yourself about the text, you will start to go deeper and deeper into your own awareness, into your own sensibility, into your own imagination, into your imaginative intelligence, your imaginative storm, your creative sensibilities. All of these will start to function as one unit. I mean, I have this image of you're a little factory and you're just plugging along 24 hours a day, awake or asleep. And the more you put into the factory, the stronger it gets and the more interesting it becomes. So this is how you can develop your performances around smaller things. Now, you can imagine this text, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, is short. So if you're doing a play, no wonder it takes 3 months to rehearse the thing. That's why I didn't ever have time to do it, because you have to go through each line asking these kinds of questions. And then you have to ask all kinds of questions of yourself as the character. How old am I? Am I hungry? Am I rich? Am I poor? Am I married? Did I fight in a war? Am I a peace activist? What year is it? How well educated am I? What's my favorite food? How often have I fallen in love? What do I like to do in the summer? So as you can see, these questions are ongoing and you can never run out of questions to ask. I'm not saying you have to do this extensively, but I am saying when you start to play around with it and you realize the range you have, and when you start developing your thinking around the piece you're memorizing, pretty soon, somewhere down the line, you will know the piece. You will not have bothered to even memorize it. It will have memorized you, and it will become part of the learning. That's why they call it learning by heart rather than memorizing. And the reason I know this will work well for you is because I've worked with a lot of people using this same technique, and the result is always very successful. People feel more engaged. They discover they're maybe a little smarter than they thought they were, and they have fun with it because their imagination is bringing things up that they hadn't thought of in years, and they're applying it to the poem. Now, does it really matter if you get all the words right? Absolutely not. Eventually, you'll get them all right, if that's even an object for you. To me, what matters is dwelling in the process, the enjoyment you get when you explore the material in front of you, like Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. You also start exploring your own creative range, your own imaginative range. And maybe one of the best benefits that comes from this, it just straight up, flat out and out feels good when you play around like this. So like I said, the goal isn't to hit the big stage and get a standing ovation, which you actually might if you do this kind of work. The goal really is to allow yourself to expand your creative and imaginative range, to wallow in the joy of your own intellectual power combined with your creative sensibilities. There's something really magical about calling on your rational mind and your imaginative mind to collaborate and work together, dance together, if you will. So as I said, I'm not an actor, but the overview that I just gave you comes from all of these acting techniques. I've been around for a long, long time. And you know, after I left UNCA and left the acting classes behind, I did go on to perform many, many shows using this technique. And for years I overacted. For years I didn't understand what I've been talking about just now. And I didn't really get it. I would just recite the words sometimes in gymnasiums with 600 people in front of me, no microphone. I just had to yell. There was no acting going on except overacting, indicating. Indicating means you point to the hill. You don't visualize it in your imagination. So my performance poetry career was mostly in the 80s, in the 90s, and a little bit in the 2000s. Around 2003, when I was living in New York City, someone recommended Susan Batson, an acting teacher, and the studio she was running at the time was called Black Nexus Studio, and it was a studio for young people, people in their 20s, aspiring leading ladies and leading men. So these folks in this studio, they were really serious. I was in my 50s at the time and hardly going to make it as an actor. I was still really curious because even after all that time, I didn't feel like I'd cracked the nut around how to really get out of my own way and live into the pieces that I was still performing. And even to this day, I still do it. As you can see, I'm doing it right now, really. So I still love this. I'm still trying to crack the nut. So thank you for helping me work a bit around this today and listening as we've gone along. So I went to Susan Batson's Black Nexus Studios, and I started taking the, it was called the Extra Actor class. Anybody could walk off the street, pay $50, spend 3 hours in these classes, and they were intense. Let me tell you, they were dramatically intense. And I also took character development classes from her, and those classes sometimes would last 4 or 5 hours, and they took place at night, and you just stayed till it was through. So I got a real feel for what was required of someone to be a professional actor. And Susan Batson worked with anybody who walked off the street, but she also had what she called a Stardust group. And some of the people in the Stardust group were well known. I think Nicole Kidman was in the Stardust group. I never met Nicole Kidman. I didn't cross her path. She worked with many of Spike Lee's actors. She also worked with Lady Gaga and also with Oprah. Now, I never met any of these people. I was just told that they were in her Stardust class. One of the things I admired about Susan, she didn't seem to care if you had a name or if you just showed up for the first time. She treated everybody with a great deal of respect, and she also demanded even beginners rigor from them. They sometimes didn't expect it. We would start the class with a 30-minute dance workout, different music going round and round and round until we were very hot. She even passed out towels. And then finally, she decided the music was finished. She would circle us up and go around the room and say, "I am aware." And she would point to each student, "I am aware." And the student would have to shoot back, "I am aware." And then she would say, "I am aware." So the student might say, "I'm aware of my eyes. I'm aware of your face. I'm aware that my mouth tastes bad. I am aware that my foot hurts. I am aware that I don't think I'll ever make it. I am aware that it's cold outside. I'm aware I can't pay my bills. I am aware that I just won a lottery ticket." And she was training us to spit things out as fast as possible without giving it a thought. And it was a magnificent thing. And then after that, she would give us scripts and have us play the scripts out between each other. And I was always behind because I didn't have the same kind of training that a lot of these people did. But it didn't really matter. What mattered was I was in the vibe. And the vibe did rub off on me. And now that I'm even talking about it now, I'm remembering back to those events, those classes. And they were really absolutely amazing. I don't know, God, I don't know if I have enough energy to do classes like that again. That was a while ago. But once you learn how to do this stuff, it really does stick with you and it carries you forward. And one of the things I loved about Susan's work, she would sit there in the class and take questions and reflect on things and give advice about how to get roles. And a lot of her actors were in the business. They would get calls all the time. So-and-so got a movie. This one got an ad. This one got a commercial. And on it would go. And she did have those Academy Award-winning actors that she worked with, absolutely. So she had a range. And, of course, actors think of themselves as artists, and they definitely are because they're developing something from nothing, putting it on their bodies, getting rid of their own egos, and taking on a brand new character. If that's not art, gosh, tell me what art is. People would often ask Susan, what is art? How do you define art? And Susan would say with a smile on her face, always more like a laugh on her face, really, she would say, well, in her mind, art is when one person, the artist, chooses to create something with the intention that what they create will change somebody just a little bit. I loved that definition because it relieves us of a lot of pressure. I don't have to change the world. I just have to make the choice to create something that might change one person just a little bit. I don't know about you, but for me, that takes off a lot of pressure. And another valuable lesson that I learned while I was in Susan's acting classes, she talked a great deal about public personas and private personas. So to personalize that idea, my public persona was one of smooth, easy, confident presentation on stage, and I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to see how good I was and how young I was and vital and with it I was. That was my public persona. And in many ways, that's a legitimate thing. I did want all of that. And it is important that you present yourself well in public. My private persona was very different. I was a little skittish. I was uncomfortable. I was uncertain of my skill level because I was pretty much self-trained. So I had to compensate a lot. So behind the scenes, I was overcompensating because of my insecurities. Now, I've kind of gotten over that. I still have it a bit, but I think we all have to struggle with those ideas between the public and the private persona. And yet Susan was saying that as an artist, the goal to have is to see if you can move your private persona and your public persona closer and closer until they marry. And the public persona and the private persona are one and the same. And then she also pointed out that when you're developing a character, often the character's dilemma, the drama of the piece, is the conflict between the private persona and the public persona, the needs that you have. What do you really, really need? What do you want? And she gave a fantastic example of how that works. In Taxi Driver, Travis, played by the young Robert De Niro many years ago, movie made by Martin Scorsese, the taxi driver works at night. He's a Vietnam vet, PTSD, really troubled. So as Robert De Niro developed the character, Robert De Niro understood that he had to examine Travis's private persona and his public persona. What were those needs? Travis was the taxi driver. His public persona, the way he saw himself, the way he presented himself to the world, was somebody who wanted to be unseen, somebody who wanted to be invisible. Thus, he drove at night. He drove in the foggy, deep, terrible areas of New York. So officially, even to himself, he wanted to remain invisible. He wanted to remain unseen. But his personal, private persona, the need he had was to be seen and loved. And thus, the contrast between the two realities, and that's what made the drama for Travis in Taxi Driver. Iris, played by Jodie Foster at 12 years old, was a prostitute on the street. Iris was young. Iris somehow befriended Travis. Iris saw Travis. She cared about him. He didn't know what to do with that. The other person who saw him was the character Sybil Shepherd played. Her name was Betsy, and she was a campaign manager for a prominent politician. And as the movie rolls along, Travis becomes more and more visible because of the things that he does. If you watch the movie, you'll see what I mean. He still keeps returning to his taxi at night, though, trying to remain invisible. So that tension between his invisibility and his visibility is always at play. And every time he crosses the path of Iris or Betsy, they see him, and he's not quite sure what to do with it. So as the movie unfolds, Travis has to deal with this tension between those two realities. And the big question sits, what will he do? which one will win? Will he go in the direction of his personal need, his personal private persona of being seen and being loved? Or will he stay with his public persona and stay invisible? If you watch the movie, you'll see what happens and you'll see what decisions he makes. There's tension there. There's drama there. And there's a reason why Taxi Driver is a classic. And when you watch it, it's hard to not watch it all the way through. It's a very powerful movie. And so we come back now to the lone driver in the sleigh in Stopping by Woods on a snowy evening. Was that driver Travis out there alone in the woods trying to stay invisible, but really wanting to be seen, really wishing he could be in the village having dinner with the man who owns the woods? We don't know this, and we can't know this. But what you can know and what I can know, we can know that we have the power to make these kinds of choices. Robert De Niro made a choice with his character in Taxi Driver. Travis made choices throughout the movie that led him in the final direction. Stopping by Woods on a snowy evening. We've all been in the sleigh. We've all been alone. You have your public persona. You have your private persona. You have needs that you may not have even discovered, and those needs may be secretly driving you. In fact, to conclude, you and I are characters in a gigantic play, and that play is the life that we're living right now. We are making these dramatic decisions as we go along. Do I eat lunch at 2 p.m. or do I eat lunch at noon? Simple decision. And yet, what surrounds that? Am I willing to show up and explore things I haven't explored before? How willing are you to push a little bit? Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and the frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year, he gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. I couldn't resist reciting Stopping by Woods on a snowy evening just one more time. I also wanted to demonstrate the difference. The first time I presented it here, it was different than this last time that I just presented it. Every time I've ever performed that poem, it's always been different. That's why this work is so delightful. And as we close, just remind you of one last thing. You've probably heard folks say, there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing original. It's all been done before. Here's the reminder. Yes, a variation of everything has been done before. What you do has never been done ever. It's completely original. It's never existed before. So the next time somebody tells you your work is not all that original, it's been done before, you can hear that whiny, snarky sort of thing. You don't have to say anything. Just know that that's completely untrue, and it's even provable, because now is the moment we have to create. And when you make something right now, recite something, write something, make food for your friends, your loved ones, whatever you do, it's always original. It's always brand new. It's always in the moment. Just like this show that I've just recorded, sitting here in Taos with my little microphone in front of me, my MacBook Air staring back at me, listening to the wind rattling in the bushes outside, and looking at the two dogs, Marley and Luna, asleep on the floor. It's a hot day today, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do this kind of work, to explore like this with you. I really do appreciate you listening and being with me, and I enjoy it so much, and I'm grateful to be able to do it. And on that note, I'll say you've been listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Walter Parks, thank you for the theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for managing KCEI-FM Cultural Energy Radio in Taos, New Mexico, broadcasting up into Alamosa, Colorado. This show always airs every weekend on both these stations, and I have both of them to thank for allowing me to put this on air on community radio. It's a really, really great privilege. And if you would like to reach me, Nave at jamesnave.com. I get an email every now and then from a few people around Taos. People do actually stop me on the street and say, thank you for airing the show. I get that in Asheville as well occasionally. And one last thing, if you are interested in writing, if you like to write and you would like to join me and my creative collaborator for our regular Saturday writing gathering, it's a great group from lots of places all over the world. We'd love to have you. You can find the information at imaginativestorm.com, imaginativestorm.com. You'll find the link and you're always welcome to tune in. I hope my reflections on acting and poetry have given you some insights, some good stuff you can use, maybe right now, who knows? I'd like to think so. So with that in mind, thank you once again for spending this time with me on Twice 5 Miles Radio. I really do appreciate it. I encourage you to lean into the world and explore the ordinary things. Whatever it is right in front of you, explore it, enjoy it. Let it be part of your life. Become more aware of it. And with that, I do hope you are able to come back sometime soon. And until then, if I'm lucky, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
James Nave here, your host for Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering, always airing first on WPVM-FM, Friday mornings at 9 and Sunday mornings at 11. My goal each week is to have a provocative conversation with an interesting guest that will inform and delight you. Twice 5 Miles Radio, Friday mornings at 9 and Sunday mornings at 11 on WPVM-FM 103.7, Asheville, North Carolina.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light.